This is Jackie Daly's show, and I have David Blackman in studio with me, which is fantastic because he's been on the show many times in the past, a repeat offender. He is with Forbes.com as a senior contributor right here based in Texas, more in the Fort Worth direction than we are. But a person who has made his career, as a matter of fact, just watching U.S. Energy, what's been going on, the trends over decades. I trust his judgment. Read him religiously. So happy to have him here. David, welcome.
Hey, thank you for having me. It's great to be here.
So I want to start with your 8 consequential energy predictions for 2023, which I found persuasive and compelling. These are the basics that everyone should know. If you want to understand where we are in terms of fossil fuels, energy transition, geopolitics, where we stand on the world stage vis-a-vis others, this is a great primer. So let's start with number one. You say renewable energy sector will see dramatic expansion in the United States during 2023. You thought this was the easiest prediction. I also thought it was the most logical to put first as I read through the order of your predictions.
Yeah.
So, okay, explain that. How can you know that for sure?
Well, the Inflation Reduction Act, $369 billion of new incentives and subsidies. You know, that's the low-hanging fruit in that piece, right? You know, it's easy to predict. I have, gosh, over the last 6 months, and in fact, just again yesterday, I've interviewed the CEOs now from 8 different startup companies who are coming into the United States to build batteries, to, you know, do solar installations and other things, other technologies related to green energy. And it's all motivated by the incentives and subsidies in that bill. And there was another $150 billion or so in the bipartisan infrastructure law that was passed in 2021. So you've got $500 billion.
Plus the state incentives on top of the federal incentives.
Right, exactly.
Or maybe even local incentives, depending on where you are.
Yeah.
And so basically what I hear you say is the government took a lot of our money out of our pocket in the forms of taxes, made a big trough and said, line up and you can have it if you have a renewable company. And this is one time of many. I remember in like 2007 or 8, I was in Washington and I felt like one day I just woke up and all of my friends were in solar energy. Like all of them, like yesterday you were a lawyer, yesterday you were a physicist, yesterday you were a staffer on Capitol Hill. Today, you've joined a brand new solar company.
Right.
And so, which was exactly the same thing as what you just described, but
happened long ago. What's coming. And it's not, you know, it's all going to get multiplied in the economy several times over because private equity is going to chase those projects that qualify for those subsidies. And, you know, it's going to be a big driver of the economy and growth, hopefully growth anyway, in the U.S. economy for a decade.
So prediction number two, which I think followed number one, not by accident, is this. U.S. electricity grids will become increasingly unstable as a result of the renewable incentives. And I ask everyone, just look around. You know, growing up most of your life, did you worry about whether or not there would be any electricity when you hit the light switch?
No,
because you're an American. You don't have those problems until now. So explain why.
Yeah, we had Central Power and Light down in Beeville where I grew up in South Texas and never had a blackout. And we had winter storms about once a decade down there, very similar to Winter Storm Uri. And you never had to worry about the lights coming on or being able to heat your home because it was all generated by coal or mainly, but natural gas as well back then. You know, and now you're trying to replace all that with, you know, 24-hour-a-day, 7-day-a-week energy with intermittent sources of energy that don't have any battery backup to speak of yet, despite all the promises of the climate lobby. And, you know, on a day like today, it's cloudy outside. Solar is not going to generate as much as it's rated for or even close. The wind's not blowing out there today. It's not blowing in West Texas today, I checked. And, you know, so you're not going to get much out of wind and solar on this particular day. And when the sun goes down, the wind tends to die at the same time sun goes down. You won't get anything for 12 hours or so. Well, you can't do that. The laws of physics don't work this way. And so it's just a natural outcome of doing what we're doing to our grid. And we're doing it here in Texas, just like they've done it in California, unfortunately. You're going to become increasingly unstable, and that's what we're seeing. And, you know, you just have to pray you don't have another event as bad as Uri this winter.
Right. So, number three, the oil and gas midstream sector will continue to be hampered by FERC. Okay, number one, for people who are not familiar, define midstream and FERC.
Okay, yeah, midstream is pipelines, basically, and processing plants for natural gas that remove the liquids and put the dry gas into the pipelines. And it's, you know, it's the part of the value chain that takes the production from the wells. That's the upstream. Midstream is the pipelines and processing. And then the downstream is refining. And so the strategy of this administration to hamper the oil and gas industry in our country has been to attack the midstream sector by denying permits for any pipeline that crosses a state line has to have a permit from the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, the FERC, and they've been holding them up. And so we have capacity constraints coming out, even over the Permian Basin here in Texas now, shortage of pipeline capacity. And it's really much worse out of the Marcellus Shale up in Pennsylvania. And you know, as long as this president is in office, it's going to get worse and worse. And that
restricts
growth.
But he talks about 9,000 leases, David.
Yeah.
What good are 9,000 leases in the upstream if you can't move the stuff with a
exactly.
pipeline, right?
Yeah. I mean, what good's drilling wells if you can't put it in a pipeline? And that's the whole strategy. So the anti-oil and gas lobby figured this out about 15 years ago, and this presidency is the outcome of it.
Well, and the saddest part of all is you point out this will hamper the growth of U.S. LNG exports at a time when the world desperately needs it. Here we can be the number one natural gas producer on Earth. If we have the way to get it to market and the incentives that are proper, Europe, obviously, Germany, desperately needing energy, otherwise relying on Russia. And here we are constraining America's ability to meet that need.
Yeah.
So isn't this helping Russia?
Oh, completely. Yes, absolutely. It helps Russia. It helps Saudi Arabia. It helps Qatar, which is a big exporter of LNG. Helps Algeria, another big exporter, Australia. But who it doesn't help is Europe.
Yeah, that's right.
Which needs natural gas. And Asian countries like Sri Lanka and Pakistan. Pakistan had an 18-hour blackout nationwide yesterday, the day before we're recording this. And it's because they don't have enough natural gas. They can't get it. Europe's eating up all the LNG exports. And we're not producing enough additional capacity right now in the United States to make up the difference for them. And unfortunately, so this is having domino effect all over the world with developing nations who really desperately need the LNG. And unfortunately, our administration is restricting that.
And really, this is a life or death issue. People don't realize if you don't have the energy you need, just like we had in Texas in 2021 with the freeze, people die. Hundreds of Texans died in that storm, and no one talks about it.
Right.
No one wants to take responsibility for that.
Right.
But in fact, I'm sure in Pakistan too, I mean, there are mountains. It is cold in some parts of Pakistan.
It is,
not to mention they have hospitals to run. So rather serious. Okay, the next is Europe's energy crisis will evolve into an energy calamity in 2023. We're hearing this everywhere.
Yeah.
Explain that.
Yeah, so, you know, the big news out of Europe for the last few weeks is that, well, we've had a warm winter, and so we're not using as much natural gas as we were afraid we would. And so we still have a lot in storage. But it's getting cold there this week, and it's forecast to stay cold, very cold, frigid cold, across Europe now for several weeks and really maybe the next couple of months. And so this is going to turn into very rapidly that storage isn't going to last very long. You know, it sounds like a lot of gas, but at winter rates of consumption, it really isn't much. And so they could go through that in a hurry. And I think by the end of this winter, we're going to have a pretty severe shortage that's going to result in pretty major price hikes, costs of natural gas and to the consumers of electricity. And I think we have to hope that it doesn't result in the same thing that happened during Uri here, where you have blackouts where people die. And I don't never want to say, you know, predict people are going to die, but, you know, that's a possibility. And then the other thing that's going to happen towards the end of the year is Europe's not going to have enough gas to refill their capacity for the following winter. And that's going to be where the real crisis is going to come.
Yeah.
And again, our restrictions on LNG export is going to play a role in that, unfortunately.
So we should be storming the beaches of Europe this time with natural gas
we should,
to come
yes.
to the rescue. And we could. We are capable if we actually had the regulatory regime that would permit it.
You're listening to the Jackie Daly Show, and I'm continuing a conversation with David Blackman. Mr. Blackman is a senior contributor at Forbes.com and also a Texas-based public policy analyst and consultant. He is the host of the Energy Question podcast, on which I will appear next week.
Your next prediction: oil prices hit $100 again in 2023. You cite to Daniel Yergin, who is one of my favorite people to read. I've read all of his books
fantastic.
Twice.
Yeah.
The Prize, The Quest, The New Map. He's a pretty smart guy.
He's a very smart guy, yes.
Yeah.
He's the vice chairman of S&P Global, and yeah.
So, all right, that means, what you really cued into that I think is important that nobody talks about. The price goes high, maybe as high as $121, when China fully reopens from COVID-19. Okay, I try to point this out. China is like many countries in one in terms of its people and its market. And so when they shut down maybe like Shanghai or a region, that is bound to have an impact on the price of the commodities, meaning the Chinese government can impact revenues of, you know, it could be Russia, it could be U.S. Oil producers or whatever, the entire market, just by making a decision about one region.
Yeah.
And so that's people don't realize maybe there's more to their decisions than COVID-19.
It could be.
Maybe there could be more going on.
There definitely could be, yes.
Because they're some of the most strategic people. So, okay, high oil prices means for us high gasoline prices.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there's no way around it. So how high do you think gas prices could go?
Well, I mean, so last year in what, May, early June, it went to $127 just for a few days. Gasoline prices spiked to $5 nationwide average, right? For regular gas. My car uses premium. So I was paying $5.60, $5.70. If it goes to $121, as S&P Global predicted in that study, then it could go to $5 again easily. And particularly if that happens, which I think is going to happen, right when summer driving season starts and demand really goes up in the United States. Well, that U.S. demand, just like China, is a big driver of global oil prices. And so when you go into summer driving season, supplies of oil always get tight. The price always goes up. It corresponds to when refiners have to start making these dozens and dozens of different summer blends of gasoline, which is also very costly and causes the price to rise. And so I just think around May and June again this year, we could see $5 gasoline prices here in the United States.
And President Biden is not going to have our strategic petroleum reserve to tap this time.
He's not.
So no, what rabbit not. Will he pull out of the hat this time?
Although his energy secretary was just on TV 2 days ago, you know, implying that that's the plan again, even though they've depleted it to 45% of its capacity, or 40% now of its total capacity, the lowest level since, what, 79, I think. They're thinking about doing it again and taking it down, I guess, to near zero.
Right. I was going to say that just effectively eliminates the Strategic Petroleum Reserve without law created by the people's representatives that say we want that.
Right. Exactly.
It doesn't matter what we want. It'll be gone. And because of bad policies, I'm still amazed even now. People ask me all the time, is it true that President Biden is really hurting U.S. energy? He keeps saying he's doing everything he can to be helpful. And I have to like count to 10, count to 10. I was counting the policies for a while. The Western Energy Alliance made a list of 80.
They're great.
They're
so
good.
They did
they're great.
Great work.
I've had them on the show. These are both policies and proposed policies to kill oil and gas production every way you can possibly imagine. Then I started adding on top of it and then lost count. I can't even keep up with 1,001 ways that they take aim at U.S. oil and gas and our energy security.
And one last thing about the SPR that people need to understand. It's there for energy security and for national emergencies. You know, as we record this, President Biden today announced we're going to send 31 tanks to the Ukraine. We are sleepwalking into a shooting war with Russia at a time when he's still wants to deplete our strategic petroleum reserve even further. You've read the prize. You know how crucial the supply chain for fuel to our tanks during at the Battle of the Bulge and the campaign in Europe, the campaign in the Pacific, won that war because we cut off their supply lines, kept ours open. That's why we won the war.
That's right. That's right.
And we're sleepwalking into this same situation again. And the president wants to eliminate our reserve. It's crazy.
Imagine if we had had a green agenda in the 1940s across every federal agency like we have right now.
We'd all be speaking German.
Yeah, there's no way.
Yeah.
Whoever, we can't emphasize enough. It's actually my favorite topic is geopolitics more than anything else.
Me too. I love it.
It's the
chessboard. I don't know enough about it, but I love it. Yeah.
It's the chessboard. And so, I mean, the two world wars are really a story of energy. It's a story of oil and gas.
Yeah.
And electricity. And how do you power your ships? You know, Churchill had to ask himself and make decisions. These were critical, pivotal decisions in the history of the world. I'm off course, but that's because it's my favorite.
No, I'm sorry.
My favorite topic.
There,
it's very important because let us never talk about the Strategic Petroleum Reserve without saying the idea that you use it to bring down gas prices is sacrilege. That is an awful misuse. And so America is now conditioned for it, but that is wrong. It is not for that purpose. Now you have good news. For American oil and gas producers, you say America's shale industry will happily stay in its new sweet spot.
Yeah.
Excellent. So what do you mean by that?
Well, we got into a sweet spot really over the last year and a half in the shale business. And it's, I know a lot of companies have complained about the pressure they've had from their investors to increase returns on investment, slow down on the drilling. For a decade during the shale boom, the big boom, everybody took on a lot of debt to drill wells, get the national production up, and did that to record levels, all-time record levels, and incredibly successful. But a lot of companies ended up going bankrupt, right? And so investors have became concerned along about 2018, 2019, started pressuring all these big producers in the Permian Basin and the other shale plays to hey, let's cut back on drilling and have some better rates of return on our investments. And that pressure has forced companies to become more efficient, more effective at what they do, streamline their operations, streamline their employee bases, their headcounts, and they become wildly profitable. The best performing sector in the U.S. stock market last year, by far, no one else was even close, was the oil and gas industry.
Yeah, so, and we were told 10 years ago, David, they would be out of business and stranded assets, right?
Yeah, stranded assets. I love that. Yeah, we can talk about a year about that.
Right.
So this year they're going to do the same thing, and they're going to do the same thing until they're pressured to do something else. And what that means is we're not going to have a huge increase in national production. It'll probably rise by 500,000 barrels a day again, just like it did last year. But the sector is going to remain very profitable with these strong commodity prices. And I think now all those companies that were itching to drill 5 years ago are really happy to just keep the same thing going. Right?
Yes.
Have a little stability for once.
You know, one of the best things about doing my show is that I know this ahead of time. I mean, I can see the writing on the wall. So I went long, very long, on LNG, royalties, oil, and coal. I knew what was coming.
Yeah.
I went through my portfolio yesterday, and I'm telling you, if it weren't for my fossil fuel investments, I would have had my tail handed to me with the index funds, you know, things that are normally considered safe. So I don't give investment advice. I'm not telling you how to invest. I'm just explaining a true biographical fact, which is that, wow, boy, am I happy I didn't believe 1,000 news stories telling me that fossil fuels were dead when the fundamentals and the math, as you said earlier, is just not there for that to change right now.
You're listening to The Jackie Daly Show, and I'm continuing a conversation with David Blackman. Mr. Blackman is a senior contributor at Forbes.com and also a Texas-based public policy analyst and consultant. He is the host of the Energy Question podcast, on which I will appear next week.
Here is, I think, the most concerning part, the last two predictions of your paper. Number one, Saudi Arabia's membership application to be approved by the BRICS, that is the BRICS Alliance, Brazil, Russia, India, China, and South Africa. And then this signals that Saudi Arabia will put an end to the era of the petrodollar.
Yeah.
And what we're talking about is oil is traded in dollars, U.S. dollars. If that changes, that's a scary, scary, unprecedented change in my lifetime. So explain why we care about that. Why is that a big deal?
Well, the United States dollar since the end of World War I has been the mark currency for all petroleum trades on the international markets globally. And that has played a very big role in making the dollar the most powerful currency on earth, right? And not just for oil transactions, but really for international trade in general. And Saudi Arabia has made a lot of noise about farming alliances with China. They're the biggest supplier to China now for crude oil. They have had numerous discussions with Xi Jinping, just came to Saudi Arabia recently, and they've had a lot of discussions about joining BRICS. If Saudi Arabia were to join the BRICS alliance, that would mean that alliance would probably be a more powerful geopolitical force than the G7 or the G20, because you would have the two biggest economies in Asia, the biggest Middle Eastern economy, the biggest economy in South America and Brazil, the biggest in Africa and South Africa, and two of the three biggest oil-producing and oil-exporting countries on Earth in Russia and Saudi Arabia, and the second biggest consumer of oil in China. You know, the United States is the biggest producer. But anyway, it would be incredibly powerful. And then if you, and Saudi Arabia, I wrote that story 6 weeks ago. Saudi Arabia just last week again said, we are certainly open to, doing oil trades in a currency other than the United States dollar. So this is not anything that they're forgetting about. This is going on. And BRICS has its annual meeting. This year it's in South Africa in September each year. And I believe that when they have that annual meeting, they're going to announce Saudi Arabia as their new member. And when that happens, it's going to have incredible geopolitical consequences for the rest of the world, particularly for the United States and Europe. And if the U.S. dollar is no longer the currency of mark for international trade, you're most likely going to see a pretty significant devaluation of the dollar because of that. And so the potential consequences for our country and every person who lives here are really enormous. And I think it's also important to note that this is happening because the Biden administration has intentionally pushed Saudi Arabia away. And it's crazy. It's just a nutty thing.
I was just about to say, Saudi Arabia would not have dreamed of making this decision 30 years ago.
Oh, no.
Wouldn't have dreamed of it.
Yeah.
It's a strange relationship, right? It's hard to know who's running the gravy train sometimes. So we could be their biggest customer, perhaps, because we consume so much. And they're sometimes the biggest consumer. They can cut us off, such as in the 70s, and show us who's boss during the Arab oil embargo. But we had this agreement that we provided defense for them. And it goes back, the relationship to, I think, the 30s, if I recall, in Jurgen's books, which is fascinating how
it is,
the world powers rushed to the Middle East to try to form these relationships. Mm-hmm. And ours was with Saudi Arabia and others. But now that's falling apart. And I think part of it is, as you said, the Biden administration has gone out of their way to do whatever they can to harm the relationship.
Right.
At the same time, we have ceded so much ground to China by forfeiture. by forfeiture. And so the Middle East, I was told by an expert who does security there, they have this strong horse mentality, which is there's so much turmoil there. They're always looking for who's the strong horse.
Right.
Because you don't want to be on the losing side of a Middle Eastern conflict.
Exactly.
So they're looking around and saying, who's the strong horse? The G7 or the BRICS?
Right.
I mean, it's probably...
And which one of those is growing, right, in terms of economic strength and geopolitical leverage?
Yeah.
Well, it's certainly not Europe and the United States.
Right.
So, yeah, you know, from there, you look at it from Saudi Arabia's self-interest, it makes perfect sense.
Right. Right. All right. I'm talking with David Blackman, and I can't believe it's been almost a half hour already.
Yes. It goes crazy fast.
I have a stack of David Blackman articles. You should not miss them. I cover a lot of them on the show and podcast. I wanted to get to Texas is flush with money, largely thanks to oil and gas. This year, Texas has $32 billion. I'll get to this in my show this week. That is an enormous, monstrous surplus.
Crazy, yeah.
When other states are struggling, and it's because of oil and gas severance taxes is the bottom line.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a lot to be learned there. And thank God we have that money. We need it. We're basically manning the border by ourselves. So we have our hands full here. But please, if you don't follow David Blackman, you really should on Twitter, LinkedIn, or his website. So tell us, what is your Twitter handle?
It's Energy Absurdity, believe it or not.
Yeah. Energy Absurdity. LinkedIn, that's David Blackman with an O at the end. And what is the URL for the website?
Blackman.substack.com. I'm on Substack and everything's there. And I try to also cut and paste my Forbes stuff, a couple of days after it goes live. And, everything I'm doing, I try to put there.
Excellent. Well, I learned a ton from reading you and following you. It's fun to finally have you in studio rather than over the airwaves or over the phone line.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Enjoyed it.
All right. Like I said, follow David, Twitter, LinkedIn, and on his website, he has a Substack column. You can support him there.
You can.
And you should. All right. That's all I've got for today. You're listening to The Jackie Daly Show.